Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. This is David Marsh, the chairman of Omfit, and I'm introducing a special podcast today between two denizens of international monetary policy. They're going to be discussing in a very broad way the framework for strategic reviews of central banks. There's one going on at the moment for the European Central Bank, but they're not going to be limited by talking about Europe. They will be talking about three different aspects here. And one is the coordination with fiscal policy and the degree to which fiscal support and fiscal stimulus allied with each other. They'll be talking about the fraught issue of central bank independence in the context of a gradual retreat from the very accommodative policies that we have at the moment. And they will also be talking about the pros and cons of central banks moving into the area of climate change, countering climate change. We have Mervyn King, Lord King, who was the former governor of the Bank of England, and his old friend and one-time sparring partner, Otmar Issing, who was the former chief economist of the Deutsche Bundesbank and then became the first board member responsible for economics at the European Central Bank when the ECB was set up in 1998. They've known each other for a long time, going back to quite a tortuous period in European monetary relations back in 1992, so nearly 30 years, and they've become firm friends ever since then. Mervyn King, as well as all his other accomplishments, is a member of the August Order of the Knights of the Garter as well, going back to the 14th century. So they both share a sense of history. I believe, Mervyn, you are one of the youngest members of the Knights of the Garter as well. So that does remind us that some of these traditions go on and on. I'm going to hand over to you straight away, Mervyn, to talk to Otmar. I'm going to absent myself from the proceedings. I'll come back again after half an hour when we'll widen this to the order. So, Mervyn King, Otmar Issing, over to you.
Thank you very much, David. And Otmar, it's a pleasure to see you. And sadly, we're not in person, but we can have our conversation. And of course, over those 30 years that we've known each other, there have been big changes in what central banks have been trying to do. But the basic framework of what a central bank is trying to achieve, monetary and financial stability, really hasn't changed. And I wondered whether we might just start by having a word about how central banks have responded to the COVID-19 crisis. Because what puzzles me about some of the response has been that it's as if central banks feel that if there is any bad news about anything, then they have to jump in and purchase large amounts of assets, that is, boost the money supply, as if this were the answer to every problem. And in the context of COVID-19, what seems slightly strange to me is that there have been very sharp falls in output and demand around all the major economies, but they haven't been the result of a traditional business cycle downturn. They've been the result of essentially governments closing down parts of the economy. And it's far from obvious that the problem we face now is a shortage of aggregate demand. If governments open up the economies, we may or may not get back to where we were, but most people believe that if we don't get back to where we were, it'll be because so-called scarring effects of the epidemic, which is an impact on supply, not demand. And yet central banks have created an awful lot of money in the attempt to boost aggregate demand as if this is the answer to the problem. And so monetary aggregates now are growing at historically extraordinarily high rates. And I wonder whether you feel that, leave to one side for the moment the fiscal response, whether the monetary response has been appropriate.
I think the role of the central bank in this situation of the pandemic, I think, was just supporting the fiscal policy, but not having an own mandate, so to say, on dealing with the pandemic. I fully agree with your assessment that this is not an usual cyclical downturn. It's very different. It's a supply and demand shock. And I think it's very important that we start from the right diagnosis, like in medicine. If you have a wrong diagnosis, you apply the wrong medicine. So the distinguishing between cyclical downturn and the pandemic impact on the economy, this is very different, and this leads to different monetary policy reactions.
So in a sense, one of the strange things that we've seen over 10 years now is that whereas monetary policy we thought was a cyclical policy instrument, sometimes rates went up to slow down the economy, sometimes they were cut to speed things up. That's a short-term response. It's not dealing with a long-term structural issue. Whereas what we've seen now for basically 12 years is a period of interest rates basically stuck at zero, low inflation and fairly low growth. This suggests that it's not obvious that monetary policy is the right tool to deal with this. And yet governments have been very slow in thinking of alternative ways of creating a diagnosis of what has been the cause of this slow growth despite extraordinarily low interest rates.
Yeah, I think fiscal policy is the moment of fiscal policy first of all. Fiscal policy can react targeted and temporary. I think this should be the headlines for fiscal policy. And this is not a time for the central banks to get out of their extremely expansionary policy, but they should be prepared for the exit. One has to prepare for the future, because what is badly needed is the reaction in the right moment, and not let developments go and stop inflationary developments, for example, before it becomes too costly for the economy. But this is not the time now, but it's a time for mentally preparing for that.
So it seems to me that given the extraordinary uncertainty of what's happened in the past year, where whatever forecast was made in January last year turned out to be worthless, what's very odd to me is that people still seem to be confident in their forward forecasts, even though we've been through an extraordinary year of uncertainty. And therefore, it's strange to my mind that central banks are willing to almost give commitments for a long time forward. Its forward guidance is becoming more and more forward. And with the Fed trying to give the impression that rates won't move for 3 years, but how on earth can the central bank today be confident of that? As you said, it seems to be a position in which all options should be kept open, and we should be prepared. Central banks should be ready, well balanced, to move in either direction depending on how they see the economy evolve. But to commit today to a very easy monetary strategy has the risk that it will then be more difficult for them to take the steps to tighten policy if that becomes necessary, when people expect them not to do that.
Yeah, as you talked about the extreme uncertainty, we always are confronted with high uncertainty, and it's a tradition to say uncertainty was never higher than at the moment. But in this situation, I think it's appropriate. And just to add one aspect, which is mostly overlooked, is the fact that many policy reactions rely on the estimate of the output gap. See the discussion in the U.S. between Blojar and Krugman, for example. But we know that estimates of the output gap are always extremely uncertain. Very often, later revisions, 2 years after the actual data, lead to a change even in the sign of the output gap. So this is tremendous uncertainty in previous times. In the pandemic, I think this uncertainty is even much greater. Take, for example, the airline business. I think there's a consensus for at least some years to come, business travel will not be the same as before. So what is the potential, what is the production potential airline business in the future? What is the output gap in this sector? And this is just an example.
So it does seem to me that one of the strange things is that certainly almost the academic discussion of monetary policy, it is still in a world in which there is a single commodity, a stuff, GDP. And yet, more than any other time in recent decades, what we see is the enormous difference between different sectors of the economy. The airline industry has seen demand collapsed. They've had to put capacity into retirement for the time being. People like Amazon certainly don't have a shortage of demand. They don't need support. Entertainment, travel, hospitality, all of these sectors are suffering enormously at present. Other sectors are not suffering so much. So there's a big change in the structure of the economy. Whether this persists, we don't know. But to talk about monetary policy in the context of a model in which there is a single output gap does seem a very odd thing to want to do in these circumstances.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This one commodity world, which seemed always strange to me, is even more problematic in such a situation of deep structural changes, of changes we have not really an idea how the economies will look like after the end of the pandemic.
Can we turn to the issue of central bank independence? Obviously, there's no immediate challenge to central bank independence in a formal sense. The ECB has been given independence as a matter of the treaty. Its legislation in the UK and the United States. So that's not, no one's talking about changing that as such. But the influence of governments over central banks, whether it's appointments of individuals, whether it's the mandates that they're given, whether it's just the indirect pressure on central banks, do you think that's likely to be an issue in the years ahead?
I think it's a worldwide issue, sir. And as central bankers, I'm sure you have the same position on that like me. Once you are praised as masters of the world, and even before, one should be cautious, because that means future decline. This expectations on what central banks can do was elevated to an extent we haven't seen before. And this is very dangerous because it means that politics, the public sector, the public at large are expecting too much. And I think de facto, on independence, we should distinguish between the legal side and the policy side. Legally, for example, the independence of the ECB is on the strongest fundament one could think of, an international treaty which can be changed only by unanimity. This is the one side. But de facto, this is very different. This is very different. Even strong legal independence might lead a central bank to be lenient on the side of de facto independence. Central banks over time have gone in a position which I would call a trap of fiscal and financial dominance. Fiscal policies with this high accumulation of debt rely on long-term interest rates, nominal long-term rates to remain low for a very, very long time, endlessly, so to say. And financial markets rely on a kind of Greenspan put. So for the time being, probably in the midst of the pandemic, there is not the time for change. But I come back to my point of the exit strategy, because the longer markets and governments rely on the support, as they call it, by the central bank, the more difficult it will be to get out of that. Not technically. Technically, it's not a problem. But this commitment to maintain price stability and to act timely, I think this will be a hard test as soon as the pandemic is behind us, and we might see a very strong endogenous recovery. This is one of the aspects you implicitly have mentioned at the beginning of our talk, because the pent-up demand enforced savings, because we cannot go to restaurants, we cannot go on vacation. So we all know many people who say, as soon as restaurants open, as soon as we can be sure that we can spend vacation in Spain or wherever, we will immediately do it. So this will be a moment of strong growth, temporary inflationary pressure, but the markets and governments must be told that central banks will not tolerate that short-term rising inflation expectations will translate into a trend. If these temporary factors disappear, I think the general notion is that inflation will fall back and inflation expectations will come back and probably fall below the 2% goal of central banks. But this is not so sure. And in this context, I would just refer to a point David mentioned in the introduction, the review of the Fed and the undergoing review, still undergoing review of the ECB strategy, on one point going the same direction, namely in the future being prepared to tolerate higher inflation for a while, because for so many years we have undershot our inflation target. So, but especially the Fed leaves totally open at what point and after what time they will stop this process. And this, I think, this implies a great risk of de-anchoring of inflation expectations.
Yeah, I strongly agree with that. I think the risk is that if inflation were to pick up in the Fed with their new average inflation targeting framework, that they would welcome the rise in inflation. They would say we want to keep it above target for a while, but then we'll bring it back down. But when they'll be pressed on, well, for how long will you let it run above target and for how far above target, they'll be deeply reluctant to give numbers. They weren't keen on giving numbers on that when they released the new framework. And I think if they do give numbers, the market will be deeply skeptical of their precision, their ability to fine-tune inflation so precisely. I mean, to say that, well, you know, we'll have inflation at 3.1% for 8 months and then we'll bring it down to 2% is a sort of mission impossible. We just don't know enough about the economy. We don't have the data to be able to fine-tune it that precisely. And the risk is that if central banks play that game and give the impression that they can fine-tune it, that people will lose confidence and inflation expectations will then become de-anchored. And I think the risk to inflation in the medium term comes primarily from initially a de-anchoring of inflation expectations, which has a momentum of its own. Then central banks feel, well, we have to do something now to control inflation. So they start to raise interest rates much faster than the market expects. That leads to quite a sharp market correction. Central banks then have to decide between, do they keep the Greenspan put going and support markets, or do they actually allow rates to go up to control inflation? And that's when the political pressure on them will be very, very great. And it will come at a point when their credibility has been somewhat undermined by making promises about future monetary policy that they can't actually follow through. And that seems to me a risk to independence could come from that.
I think what is interesting to note is already, take the case of the ECB. The ECB seems to be already in a trap of first analysis. The ECB has announced it will sustain favorable financial conditions for some time, a year or more than a year to come. And now there's a small but still relevant rise in inflation expectations, which brings up inflation and expectations closer to the goal of approaching 2%. But this gets in contrast, in conflict with the aim of maintaining favorable financial conditions, at least nominally. So by announcing this course, the ECB more or less has de facto applied yield curve control, keeping the interest rates low via purchases of assets, of all kind of assets. So should the ECB not praise that inflation expectations are rising in the direction they had always wished it to happen? So this is already a kind of harbinger of future problems.
So it's fascinating that you mentioned yield curve control, because I mean, some central banks and many commentators have recommended that we go down this path in a desperate pursuit of trying to get faster economic growth. But the odd thing is that it was exactly abandoning yield curve control that enabled the Federal Reserve in the early 1950s, with this accord between the Fed and the Treasury, to start behaving like a truly independent central bank. And during the war itself, they felt they had to do this to reduce the cost of war finance. And after the Second World War, there was a struggle to get out of it. And it really led to a sharp conflict between the Fed and the US Treasury, where it was the abandonment of yield curve control that enabled the Fed to take steps to control inflation and become an independent central bank. Some central banks almost seem to want to go back to that world. And I find that very peculiar.
It's interesting because some people compare the pandemic with the war against the virus. So it's, in this sense, it's again wartime.
Yes.
And once the war is open, it has ended, like in the post-war period, I think the central bank, the ECB, cannot wait 6 years like the Fed in 45 before declaring exit from a wartime framework.
So in the last few minutes, let's turn briefly to the one aspect of a challenge to central banks, which is sort of green finance and green central banking. It is striking how many central banks have taken up the cudgels in the fight against climate change. This has nothing as such to do with their basic remits, but I noticed that in the UK, the Chancellor has changed the remit of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee to include considerations of sustainability, net zero carbon. This they have to take into account when engaging in purchases of corporate bonds. I have great respect for my colleagues still at the bank, but one thing I know they're not is experts on climate change. And they're being sucked into something which really is a matter of government policy. But what's your reaction to this embracing of green issues by central banks?
I'm not surprised that governments want to burden central banks with such a responsibility. What strikes and worries me really is that central bankers themselves are seeming to yearn for such a role. So in public, of course, they should accept that and should even make a statement that climate change is probably the biggest challenge of our time. But to what extent central banks can contribute to the fight against climate change, this is a different issue. To some extent, climate change has an impact on many variables, growth, inflation, all kinds of economic variables which enter economic forecasts, inflation forecasts. So implicitly, central banks take account of such developments. And as far as they are regulators and supervisors, they have to deal with uncertainties, challenges for the fragility of the financial system, considering all kinds of financial assets. But this is a different role. We are talking about monetary policy. And here I don't see a big problem that central banks giving the impression that they can contribute to the solution. They commit themselves to something which they cannot control. And this is something is neither an individual nor an institution should ever do. And by the way, central bankers are appointed to deliver on their mandate. Price stability, Fed, full employment, and in the case of the ECB, you have a number of secondary objectives, but this is not their core business. The core responsible for dealing with climate change is the responsibility of governments, of politicians, who in the end are responsible to their voters. This is a political issue, like income distribution, etc. It's an important goal, of course, might be the overwhelming goal of our time, but this is nothing in which central banks can play a special role. And if they give the impression or even promise to deliver what they cannot achieve in the end, I think they risk acceptance of their independence, because they are not made independent to do political make political decisions.
You can see another example of this very clearly in the case of the Fed, where the Fed appears to have given the impression that one of its objectives is to improve the employment prospects of particular sectors of the population. And important though that is, the idea that monetary policy can affect the unemployment rates or participation rates of particular groups in the economy seems completely far-fetched. Of course, you can run the economy at a very hot rate to try to boost employment in aggregate. But to go further than that and to say that your objective is to help the employment rates of particular sectors is to give the impression that this is something that you can genuinely influence in a long run way, when I don't think anyone really believes that. And it gives the government an excuse for not tackling these big structural problems, whether it's climate change, whether it's the fate of particular groups in the population, whether it's gender inequality. Governments find it very convenient to try and say, oh, we've asked the central bank to do something about this. And central banks do seem puzzlingly willing to take on that responsibility, whether that's because in the short run they want that popularity for being seen to be on the right side of events. I don't know, but that's usually a recipe for failure down the road.
I think this is an important point, because the more the central bank is following the idea to deliver on specific issues like employment of certain part of the population, etc., environment is the same, the more there is a tendency, even a need to apply specific instruments. Because interest rate policy applies to the whole economy. It has impact on exchange rate, on all developments, etc., but not on specific issues here and there, not on sectors of the economy, not on sectors of the people. So the next step will be to demand specific actions for specific purposes. And to my mind, this is the end of the central bank independence. Or put it the following way, I would not be in favor of giving independence to a central bank which applies specific instruments of this kind, because this is a political responsibility. And central banks are not made independent to deliver on specific political issues.
Well, as ever, words of wisdom from you, Otmar. Let's bring David back in. He's probably champing at the bit to come in and talk to us both. But thank you so much, Otmar, for our bilateral conversation. David, over to you.
Yes, thank you, Mervyn. Thank you, Otmar. That worked out very well.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.